Services. This is Tuesday, the 1st of May, May Day. Senate Bill 5527. Where's our poll and our ribbons? You can tell what generation I grew up in. Department of Human Services, Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. And this is an overview we're beginning to hear. And Mr. Olson, will you begin?
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. You have before you today the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs public hearing on their budget. I provided to your offices yesterday a memo and a brief outline. I also provided a copy to the office here, and they were kind enough to copy that and put it in your notebooks.
Oh,
you happened to left that in your office, you've got a copy of it in your
notebooks. They must have been listening to some of our...
They know how that works.
Oh, we lose everything.
Yeah.
The governor's recommended budget is a 14.5% increase over the 9901 estimated expenditures, with general fund increasing 80.1%. Other funds, revenue comes primarily from two sources, the state tax on beer and wine and fees or fines paid into the intoxicated driver program through the criminal fines and assessment account. I provided for you two charts there. The first is shows the source of funds for the office. Again, 41% comes from general fund and the lottery funds. The lottery funds finance the gambling prevention and treatment services. And again, the primary source of other funds is the beer and wine tax and the intoxicated driver program. And then revenues are received from a variety of federal programs. The second graph there, the bar chart, shows the growth of the office over the last three biennia. Total budget has grown 90% since 1995-97. The total budget is up 15% from 9901 estimated expenditures, with general fund up over 80%. And we'll get into some of the details on that as we progress through this. During the 9901 legislative session, the adopted budget included an additional $10 million to be used for program enhancements. During the 1997 Legislative Assembly, the office was directed to study the restructuring of the residential rate reimbursement system. And that was completed in September of 99, and the system was implemented in May of 2000. At the November Emergency Board meeting, November 2000 Emergency Board meeting, as part of the Department of Human Services rebalance plan, they came back with a request to increase the funding for the enhancements due to expenditures for the rate restructuring actually exceeded the original estimates, and so that request was made. The Emergency Board requested the Department of Administrative Services to unschedule those funds pending the office returning to the January 2001 Emergency Board meeting with a more detailed request and additional information. And at that meeting, the Emergency Board approved rescheduling $1.5 million general funds, $1.4 million other funds, and $5 million federal funds related to the program enhancements. In addition, during the interim, office was found to be out of compliance with the federal SINAR amendment, and a penalty was assessed. Prior to that penalty being implemented, the department and the governor's office negotiated with the federal government and reached a compromise. That compromise required the state to spend an additional $944,000 on the program. So during the interim, the Emergency Board approved $150,000 other funds from the beer and wine tax to be spent for that, and then in the January 2001 meeting, the Emergency Board approved $794,000 general funds to improve for the enhancements to that program and to comply with the negotiated agreement. And with that, Madam Chair, we have with us today Barbara Simaglio, the Director of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. And that's it.
And I think that Kelly Fields is sitting there.
And Kelly is here.
See, I'm getting my name, Senator Z. Welcome.
I think it was Dave Frazier that you call him Mike.
Yes. But he has a brother named Mike.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Could I ask Mr. Olson a question?
Yes.
Now, you said that there was a study to restructure the residential rate reimbursement system. The study was completed in September 99, and a redesigned residential rate system was implemented. So, is the residential rate higher than what it was, and in governor's budget, was it carried out?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, yes, it was higher. It was restructured, really. It
mm-hmm.
was, and Bill, the department will get into it.
Okay.
In the governor's recommended budget, there is the $10 million that was included in the 9901 legislatively adopted budget is included in the base budget of the governor's recommended budget. The increased limitation in general fund allocation that was approved in the January 2001 emergency board is not included in the base budget, but it's part of a decision package, a policy package, in the governor's recommended budget.
Follow up, Madam Chair. So the restructuring of the residential rate will be introduced as a policy package?
Madam Chair, Senator, you know, the restructuring is actually part of the service level budget. That some additional funding for the program enhancements is part of the policy package.
Oh, I see. And you'll go into more detail later on.
Good morning, Chair Winters, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Simaglio. I'm the administrator of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs, which is an office in the Department of Human Services. I'm with you today to review our program and give you an overview. We have tried to follow your outline, so the book that you have is organized according to the sections in the questions that you gave us to follow. So just if it makes it easier, it's all marked, so we tried to keep it easy to follow. And I'll try to move through this fairly quickly and give you a high-level overview, and then be happy to answer questions as you may have them. Just before I get into the office mission, I just want to make a few comments about the alcohol and drug abuse services and programs in general. The idea of funding for alcohol and drug abuse programs is relatively recent. The growth of these services really has been since the 70s, when we first experienced in our country a tremendous rise in drug use, largely among our youth at the time, which brought attention to this problem, which had largely been ignored when it didn't affect the middle class. But when it moved into the middle class, we had a huge awareness of the issue. That led to the federal government providing block grants to each state to begin providing services for drug treatment primarily. And in Oregon, as in many states, the first type of services that became available were the detox programs, because at the time that was the type of service that people judged to be best practice, was to bring people in off the street, detox them, and hopefully help them get clean and sober and maintain that sobriety. From that time in the 70s, we have seen a phenomenal need continue to grow, as well as a phenomenal growth in the science by which we practice drug and alcohol treatment. So we've moved from those early days of basically just keeping someone safe and off the street to a highly evolved system of clinical treatments and supports that really attempt to treat the person in a more holistic fashion. At the same time, we've evolved a set of services that are preventive in nature and attempt to work with the whole community, raising awareness, developing programs and services to help young people and families know the dangers and risks of drugs and avoid those dangers and risks. So in the past 25 years, we've seen a tremendous evolution of this field in general. And so our office, like, again, many other states, has experienced a phenomenal growth in trying to keep up with the demand for services. Unfortunately, at the same time our treatment and prevention has evolved, so has the drug situation out there, and we're now stressed by the methamphetamine and heroin epidemics that we see in Oregon, the drug trafficking going from Canada down to Mexico with a number of outposts in our state. And this has become one of the greatest challenges that our country has faced, as I'm sure you're well aware. We're questioning our approaches, we're questioning whether what we're doing is working, and we're furiously struggling with how do we meet the challenge of this issue in our community. In DHS here in Oregon, we find that, for example, in our SCF population, about 60% of the families in child welfare have some alcohol and drug-related issue. We find that in corrections, 70 to 80% of the clients have drug involvement. So we know that in order to solve or address some of these other issues in our state, drug treatment and intervention is a critical component. Some areas have developed far more quickly than others, and we have as our goal and mission to prevent and reduce the problems related to alcohol and drugs for all Oregonians. And so our goal is to develop an equitable system across the state of services to help our citizens. The way we accomplish our particular mission, which is, as I said, limited to the alcohol and drug prevention and treatment, the way we provide that is very much through partnerships. We provide leadership. We work with partners such as child welfare. The governor has made this a priority in his social strategy for social support. We've been a focus of last session's Senate Bill 555 in providing leadership and partnership for local planning to make sure that the local service plans include a focus on alcohol and drug issues. We guide public policy. We work with managed care. Alcohol and drug services are, as we say, carved into the health plan. They are part of the physical health benefit, recognizing that addiction is a disease. It has a medical brain disease connection and must be treated by not only social counselors and with their professional expertise, but also there's a very important medical component that must be attended to. We manage information. We collect data on all clients that are served by state-funded services. We link with OMAP for the Medicaid clients and analyze that data. We are charged with maintaining standards. We license anyone who provides alcohol and drug services in the state. We build competencies, again, because of the quick growth of our field. Much of the responsibility for training counselors has fallen to the office because the colleges and universities had not had traditionally the expertise to train professionals in addiction. And finally, we create linkages. As I mentioned, everything we do is in partnership, and it is the responsibility of our office to sort of connect the dots and make sure that we're getting all the right partners together to integrate alcohol and drug services into their work. In the 99 legislative session, our office was also charged with administering the gambling programs that are funded by the state lottery. And so the funds that are dedicated to that activity came over to our office to manage. So also in this year, in this past biennium, we've been charged with developing and putting forth a new system of services for prevention and treatment of gambling, which we also do with our county partners. We provide no direct service ourselves. Our job is limited to administration and support, training, technical assistance, licensing and monitoring, et cetera. All of the direct services are provided through the county mental health system, either directly or through contracts with local nonprofits. Next, I'll just review our organization. I'll call your attention to page 4 in our book, which has a high-level organization chart. There is a more detailed chart in Appendix 1, and it simply lays out the areas of focus. As I said, ranging from quality assurance and program development, workforce development, to planning, evaluation, and research, fiscal. And I didn't plan to get into a lot of detail on that at this time, but I will as we go through the rest of the presentation. The Community Services Office focuses primarily on program and policy development, and there are 10 FTEs devoted to that. The quality assurance component of the office is charged with interpreting and administering the rules that govern alcohol and drug treatment and issues the licensing letters of approval. They do approximately 150 site reviews a year in carrying out that work. The workforce development unit of our office is 4.75 FTE and focuses on the training and coordinating technical assistance. Our office has developed over 30 drug and alcohol training courses that we provide largely through contracts to community counselors, and we've been moving more towards trying to get these courses instituted in local colleges and universities so that we can evolve this responsibility down to the community level. It's been a challenge because, as I said, this isn't a traditional area of responsibility for the local colleges and universities. We've also this year had a focus on the Adoptions and Safe Families Act, which I think you've heard about with services to children and families, with the new federal requirements for time limits for how long a child can remain in foster care. It's put a tremendous pressure on that system to offer services to the parents. And because about 60% of those parents have alcohol and drug-related problems, it's essential that we offer them treatment services. This has been a big driver in our need to get additional services into communities to meet that demand.
What percentage of your funds are going targeted towards that particular objective?
Chair Winters, toward working with the services to children and families,
particularly dealing with those children whose parents are at the potential of having their parental rights terminated. And what, and you stated that 60% of the service children families client group have alcohol or drug related issues. So what percentage of your dollars is going towards that population?
Chair Winters, we will get you that answer to that. As we've tried to develop these services, it's difficult to separate because as our funding goes down to the counties, we don't necessarily segment everything according to, you know, to each system. But we do have at the local level a number of programs that are specific to women and children, so I can try to get you an answer with as specific a breakout of that as we can.
My second question then is, does the data that you collect from the counties, since a large share of your money goes to the counties for local programs, do they report back to you by category in specific kinds of areas that would be of interest to us at the state level?
Chair Winters, the way the data is reported back is basically in demographic information. So we get, you know, male, female, age, race, the traditional, and then we would also get primary drug of abuse, referral source, information like that. So it wouldn't, I'm not sure if that's getting to what you're asking, but
if I wanted to know how successful a county was, or how what a county is doing with the dollars that you're giving them, that what results that the counties are having, is that the kind of information that you collect from the counties?
Yes, and Chair Winters, as we get through the presentation, I'm going to talk a little more in depth about our outcome information and how we measure that. I want to just kind of wind up the overview on this section of community services by mentioning again the problem gambling. We took this program over and were charged with developing a statewide infrastructure for problem gambling. This is a new area and a new area for the state. It's just been several years since these programs have been available. And DAS had gotten that program started and then turned it over to our office in this biennium. And so our goal there is to develop a system similar to what we've done with alcohol and drug, where we have these services available throughout the counties and throughout the state. Our next unit is the Planning, Evaluation, and Research Unit, which has 11 FTEs. This unit processes all the data on the client information, which you asked about, and they input that manually. We have not yet been able to totally automate that system. It is a goal, but it's all inputted manually at this point, and this group does the analysis of the data. They conduct the Oregon Student Drug Use Survey, which some of you are familiar with, that surveys more than 12,000 students biannually. We oversee the Oregon Household Survey, which does a similar survey of Oregon adults to determine the need for alcohol and drug services. They've done been part of the evaluation for Senate Bill 555 with the Governor's Office and the Commission on Children and Families, and also per the legislative session have taken leadership in organizing the collection of outcome information, which we'll be getting into in more depth. And this is the first year that we've been able with support.
Barbara, are you talking about the youth behavior survey biannually when you mentioned biannual survey of the youth assessment?
Chair Winter, Senator Yee, we had done historically for the past 10 years the Oregon Student Drug Use Survey, which was a separate survey from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. We have, in this past biennium, been working very closely with the Health Division and have now developed a model that integrates the Youth Behavior Risk Survey and the Student Drug Use Survey. So we'll only be administering one survey to meet all of our needs. The reason we've gone toward an integrated model is largely to reduce the burden on the schools for having separate surveys done. So we have moved toward that integrated model.
Follow up. I understand the youth behavior survey is being discontinued in funding. So am I correct? I heard that in the Health Division.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, not to my knowledge.
Oh, I see.
I don't believe that's been discontinued. I'll follow up on that.
Yes, we follow up on that. So if that's discontinued, at least we have your survey that's done annually on the alcohol assessment of youth.
Senator Yee, my name is Gwen Grahams, and I'm the manager of the planning unit at ODAP. Of winners. Actually, I believe it's our funding that is in most trouble with these student surveys. We have been dependent on federal funds to administer our survey for the past 10 years. We're hoping to get some funds back again, but the SICA program, which funded part of our survey, is going to terminate in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Well, follow up, Madam Chair. I guess we can use one or the other. But I guess we don't need both.
Senator Yee, yes. We have a combined survey now with the Health Division. So it's called the Oregon Healthy Teens Survey. Mm-hmm. And that is the one that will be administered for both of the agencies.
Yes. And Mr. Olson will follow up to see the status of the youth survey. While I have the floor or the opportunity, I want to say, when you give us the organization chart, can you give us in 2 years, the previous biennium and the next biennium, so we have a comparison. We can see right away which unit has increased in FDE and which unit is being reduced. So maybe we don't need to say that again. Just ask any divisions that come with organization chart, give us a comparison of the previous biennium.
And your proposed biennium. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted, while we're talking about the different surveys, I too was concerned about having multiple surveys, having worked at the community level. We've actually started the conversation with Gwen Grahams, met with me in my office along with representatives from the Health Division about not only coordinating those two surveys, which they're already doing, but also local commissions on children and families are surveying for positive youth development factors, and some of those are not included in the survey. So my goal is to try to help or work with the agency and see what we can do about maybe further coordinating at the local level. So I just wanted to make that comment. And then my second question you partially answered. I had understood that SICA, the State Incentive Cooperative Agreement, was going away. When is that happening and how much money is that? And the other concern that I have about that is that not only does that help with your surveys, but I understand there are actually coordinators at the local level, at least in the counties that I work with, have SICA coordinators that have been really helpful in doing prevention types of planning functions in the counties. And do you have any thoughts about what's going to happen there when they go away?
Chairwoman, it's Representative Carlson. The good part about getting a federal grant is it allows you to do a lot of things. The bad part is that they end after 3 years, and that's what we're facing with the state incentive cooperative agreement. This was a 3-year federal grant. We had $3 million a year for each of 3 years ending this fall. And we were able to add coordinators, prevention coordinators in communities where there weren't designated coordinators for alcohol and drug, and we were able to do program development. What we're attempting to do is backfill some of that with additional funds that we've had through the expansion this year, and then also help people sort of restructure, working more collaboratively between our office, the commissions, the health division, to really look at how to gain more efficiencies through the resources that they have. We've spent a lot of time this past biennium working toward integrated planning, and the reason for that is we believe if people are working better together, that with the loss of funds, they will be able to pick up some of that slack because they become more effective and efficient. Now, that certainly won't replace the amount of money that we had with that grant, but we hope it will help. We don't anticipate that there will be any new federal grants that would replace this size of a grant. Okay. Moving along, the another federal grant that we have, which is an integral part of our structure, is the Northwest Frontier Addiction Technology Transfer Center, which we call NFATSE. This has 9 FTE. It's totally federally funded, and it is part of a system of regional technology transfer centers that the federal government has funded for the past 5 years now to provide training and technical assistance to the Northwest, and there are other centers around the rest of the country. This is an area where Oregon has taken great leadership in developing courses and providing training for addiction in partnership with colleges and universities. And we are actually noted nationally for the good work that the NFATSE has done. We will be reapplying. We hope to reapply for this grant in Oregon. We are not yet sure if our office will be reapplying or whether we'll be doing this in partnership with OHSU. Again, one of our goals is to see that this gets established in a permanent home, perhaps more appropriately in a university. So we're exploring that right now. And this grant will be up for renewal later on this spring. Finally, our org structure has fiscal operations, which does your normal contract budgeting, et cetera, and we have 7 FTE in that area. Next, I'll be moving on to the overview of the programs and services. That begins on page 10 and corresponds with number 2C on your list of questions. As I said, we do not provide direct services. All of the direct services provided through counties and local providers, some of which are regional direct contracts. The services that we deliver through our funding are based on a framework developed by the Institute of Medicine under the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C., and that is called the Spectrum of Intervention. And it assumes that there are a spectrum of services that need to be delivered in order to address the issue, beginning with prevention. Universal prevention, which targets the whole population, moving through treatment for people who have identified problems and disorders, and then moving through on to maintenance for people who have gone through treatment and need aftercare and longer-term supports. We'll be getting into more detail on each of those services in a little while. I want to talk next about the planning process, just to give you an overview of how we organize our services. Senate Bill 555 actually did some restructuring to our planning process, moving us toward a more integrated approach, working with other agencies such as the Commission on Children and Families. The charge to do that overview planning is with the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. That was created in 85 by the legislature to work with all of the agencies that provide some type of alcohol and drug abuse services. In other words, community corrections, Department of Corrections, state police, transportation, all of those agencies do have some connection with alcohol and drug programs, whether it be through the Department of Transportation and the Drinking and Driving, the DUIs, which are under their purview, or the Department of Corrections with the institutional programs, or OYA, or community corrections who buy some services from our system. There's a need to have better coordination, and that falls to the Governor's Council to develop an annual plan and present that to the legislature. I believe they've just submitted it or are in the process of submitting that to you. They set guidelines which then direct the local alcohol and drug planning councils. Each county has a local alcohol and drug planning council that are charged with advising and approving the local mental health director in the plan for each county. And then when we get those county plans, we go through a review for prior to implementation to make sure that those plans are meeting the statewide goals. So our attempt is to be comprehensive in our planning at the state and local level, so that we're working in a purposeful way to accomplish goals. On page 11 and 12, there's an overview of and a schematic on the top of page 12 that explains a little bit more about the funding systems, which can be a little complicated. Our office being the main state office responsible for funding alcohol and drug services, but also, as I mentioned, the health plan does have services in both the fully capitated health plans as well as in the fee-for-service program to pay for treatment for health plan enrollees. And we also give direct funds to the tribes. Not every tribe has a dedicated program, but our goal is that each tribe as well as the counties would be included in the service plan. You mentioned the SICA grant, and that was a good opportunity to really include the tribes in our prevention efforts.
Barbara, do the tribes still get health and welfare dollars from the federal government in addition to our partnership, do you know?
Chair Winters, yes, I believe they do, although the amount has been greatly reduced. I know they've experienced some cutbacks in the funding that has been available, particularly for alcohol and drug. I don't have the exact dollars that they get, but I could we could look into that. Okay. We do have a strategic business plan, and on page 13, I'm not going to go through each point by point, but I do want to tell you in 98, we went through an extensive planning process. We had regional meetings and involved a number of partners and stakeholders around the state in a process that created our strategic plan. We detailed 9 strategies that have been guiding us since the development of that plan.
Those strategies
on page 13. This is just a high-level summary. We do have a complete plan if you would like a copy of that. This plan has been guiding us, and the focal points have been several. One is in increasing public awareness, and we focus primarily on inhalant abuse as directed by the 9901 legislature and on underage drinking, which has been a federal charge that our office has received responsibility for to develop increased awareness on underage drinking. We've also had a focus on local planning, improving the local planning systems, as I mentioned, in connection largely with Senate Bill 555. And then finally, reinventing our policies to be more holistic. Historically, many alcohol and drug services were delivered in a fairly narrow way, in that a person would come into treatment and be treated for alcohol and drug, but there weren't necessarily extensive connections with other issues, such as jobs or housing or other challenges that this individual or family might be facing. We have worked very diligently to try to make those connections so that we are working in the context of the whole DHS, looking at how these services integrate with other supports. And our rate restructuring, which was mentioned earlier, and our improved way of contracting has given more flexibility at the local level for counties and programs to develop more flexible plans. Prior to this last biennium, we were fairly rigid in the way we did our contracting. We would tell a county, you get so many slots of this kind of treatment and so many slots of this kind of treatment, and that's what you need to provide. What we've moved toward is asking them for an implementation plan so that they could structure their money in the way that best meets their needs, so that we're not making the judgments about what types of treatment are best suited to those local needs. Now, that's a process. We've just begun this transition, and it really does require time to move from the system where we were very prescriptive to one in which it's more of a partnership with outcomes, where we're saying we want to move toward increased flexibility with more attendant measurable outcomes.
Is and it your making this shift thinking that you would probably produce better results for the client?
Chair Winters, absolutely. I think one of the driving forces is that we feel our clients have very complex problems, and we need to be more focused on how to meet that complexity and do a better job. So the underpinning of this shift is to improve how we're doing business all the way around.
Will it be possible, because and I think sometimes when we make shifts and we change what we're doing, we don't retain the base data and in order to do a comparison with the shift. And it's my hope that if you're making a shift, that you're able to encapsulate your outcome information that doesn't get, so it doesn't get lost somewhere. And
Chair Winters, the 9901 legislature actually charged us in our budget with a particular item, which was to develop an outcome study, and we've done that this year. We're going to share that data in the book here, and that is our baseline data. So we've begun that, and then as we shift, we will be able to compare how things are progressing from 9901 on forth.
But nothing prior to 9901, is that true?
Well, we do have Chair Winters' basic data. You know, we have the basic client data, how many people were served, we do have information about how they progressed after treatment, but it won't be as in-depth as what we are able to do now. We just didn't have the personnel or the system set up in order to do that until we've worked on developing that this year. Did you want to add anything?
Okay. Senator Yee.
Madam Chair. Barbara, what kind of coordination do you do with the health division in treating the fetal alcohol syndrome babies? Because when we asked health division, they said they refer the women and child clinic clients, mothers, pregnant women, who are alcohol or drug abuse users, they are referred to the prenatal care. But since they don't provide treatment themselves, they refer them to the private prenatal care treatment. But my question is, what kind of coordination do you have with the Pell Division so they can refer those users to your clinic, your treatment program, so that they can have care at the right time?
Chair Winters, Senator Yee, we actually have a number of services around the state that are treatment that are women and children specific. So we do have providers that are focused on women's treatment. For example, there's one in Medford that has been a model that actually works with local physicians, with a public health nurse, and makes that connection directly to get pregnant women into treatment who are assessed to need that. We wish we could do more of those, and our hope is to be able to build those services around the state. There are not a lot of providers who are necessarily in the position to build those kinds of services, so we have several, but it is an area where we hope to do some growing. One of our priorities is treatment for pregnant women. That is not only a state priority, but we're directed by the federal government to make that a priority with our block grant dollars. Being part of DHS, we're a sister agency to the health division, so we do work closely. Also at the county level, the public health departments are local, as are the mental health. So at the local level, they all work for the same commissioners. So we're hoping that local direction brings those services together as well. I think the issue of fetal alcohol syndrome is one that we hope to be able to do more on. With the governor's children's plan that's in our recommended budget, one of the areas of focus is high-risk women. And with firstborn children or prenatal care, those women who are screened as at risk, and the fetal alcohol at risk people there would fall into that category. Our hope is that we would do systematic screening so that we could identify those women when they come in contact with the local home visiting people, through the health division and the Commission on Children and Families, so that if they appear to need some help and intervention with alcohol and drug, we can get them into treatment as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. We also would hope to do some additional public awareness in this area, because as I think you've pointed out, there is not a lot of public awareness that even you know, what might not be considered heavy drinking might be a problem. You know, drinking when someone is pregnant is always a risk, and we need to get that message out.
Barbara, it just seems to me that, well, when we ask Health Division that question, they say that the women who are found to be alcohol and drug users are referred to prenatal care, but they don't provide prenatal care. Therefore, they refer them to private physicians. They didn't specifically mention that they refer them to your division for treatment. Mm-hmm. So I hope you have a discussion with Health Division and come back with a report to us what kind of coordination you have in referring those women specifically to your treatment program.
We will follow up on that.
Representative Bates.
Several questions are basically interlocked here, Madam Chair. I'm from Medford. I'm a physician, and the program you're referring to is Rhea Sullivan's program for residential care for pregnant women who are tested positive or who are self-referred usually or from physicians. I probably come from a situation which I assume that was sort of the state norm. Mm. You indicated it's not.
No.
And that's disturbing. Okay. The program we have there is a limited one. It doesn't get to everybody, but if it's one of the best in the state, I'm concerned about what the rest of the state is doing then, especially the amount of money flowing into this program. I'm And so I would ask him questions. I'd like to know if you have any idea of how many pregnant women are being tested for drug abuse in their pregnancy. It's a local issue, but I'd like to know if you have some figures on that. I'd like to know if, as a follow-up, what the percentage of infants being born are positive for drugs still, knowing that we can't even pick up alcohol usually because it's so short in the body. Knowing also that fetal alcohol syndrome is probably the most devastating problem we have with newborns, even worse than cocaine, heroin, and other addictions, which appear not to have long-term effect if you can break the cycle. I'm also concerned about the type of surveys you're doing. These are primarily, I think, reporting surveys. You ask a question, they give you an answer. When we did that as a pilot project in the Medford area on pregnant mothers, there was not a good correlation between what they reported and how they tested. So there was a lot of denial going on. And even when you do test them positive for, especially for meth, they'll tell you they were taking, you know, Sudafed or something else. So there's so much denial in that reporting system. I'm concerned about how accurate that reporting system is. And maybe you can give us some information. Not that you've combined reports, which I think is good, that you've cut the reports down, but what do you think your accuracy really is? And the last piece, and I'll leave you alone.
Okay. All right. I'm just anxious to answer.
is outcomes. Right. So hard to measure in this group. So difficult to know where you're really at. And looking through the data here, I'm concerned that you're not having an ability to capture any outcomes of whether your programs are successful or not, which is a statewide, nationwide, worldwide problem, of course. Thank you.
Chair Winters, Representative Bates. Well, I think, as you point out, this is an area where we know we have a long way to go. What we've been able to do, I think, is to learn a lot about what does work and what we need to do if we're going to be successful. Unfortunately, we have a couple of problems. We don't have enough resources, which isn't just about money by any means. It's about trained staff, people who want to do this work, people who know how to do the coordination, people who have the awareness and commitment to work with these clients and these women. And I think, you know, if you put all those challenges together, money's probably not the biggest problem. These folks are very difficult to work with. As you mentioned, it's a challenge to get good information. We don't have any way to screen people non-voluntarily, and I think I heard your discussion with the health division that can lead to a whole lot of other issues. But because of the stigma related to alcohol and drug use, particularly among women, particularly when women fear that they may have their babies taken away from them, it just compounds the challenge of how to work with this very at-risk population. I think the answer lies in something you said. If a community is willing to come together to try to do some work on this, private physicians, public agencies working together, we may be able to make some progress. But if we don't get that kind of interest on the community's part, there's very little we alone can do. You're absolutely right about the data. I think one of our benchmarks is alcohol and drug use during pregnancy. And we get an A. They say we're meeting our target. There was just an article in the paper a couple of weeks ago that this is one of the poorest measures that we have nationally because it's self-reported, because there's really no way to accurately know if someone's drinking heavily during pregnancy. So I think what this requires is a great deal more prevention, education, so that people in the community understand these issues and the seriousness. I think it requires a commitment on the parts of the public and private sector health communities to talk about alcohol and drugs. We've had a requirement in the health plan that physicians screen for alcohol and drug issues. We don't know exactly how many physicians ask those questions or really follow up, but we suspect we have a long way to go there. These are just not easy issues to address. And, you know, what we consider our part is to keep raising the issue and trying to help our program move along in being able to serve these difficult clients. But the key is definitely working in partnership. Hope I've, you know, I wish I had a better answer, but this is probably one of the greatest challenges that we face in our system. Okay, I was talking about our strategic plan, and I think we've highlighted some of the things we're trying to work on in terms of system effectiveness, outcome studies, being more culturally specific, and having the kinds of treatment that meets individuals' and families' needs at the local level. We are also doing some piloting in managed care to look at how we can move toward a more integrated behavioral health model, because at least half of our clients are challenged not only with alcohol and drug, but with a mental health disorder, which makes
what percentage of your clients with alcohol and drug, and that you would say that you partner with mental health or have the dual diagnosis of depression?
From our statistics, about 40% of the clients in our in our caseloads have a dual diagnosis. That's okay. About 40% of our
40%.
Of the clients in our system have a dual diagnosis, and most of those in our treatment programs probably have a secondary diagnosis of depression, anxiety. We do not in our programs deal with the severe and persistent mentally ill. Those folks would be primarily in the mental health systems caseload.
But there's some
and they also have dual diagnosis. So when you put it all together, it's probably anywhere from 40 to 60%, depending on which program you're looking at, and you know, which community.
Representative Schrader.
I guess I just get concerned as I hear you talk that there seems to be the potential for a lot of duplication. I mean, we've seen this in other DHS budgets where several different organizations seem to be case managing the same individual, and I guess I'm not convinced that that's not happening on a somewhat regular basis.
Chair Winters, Representative Schrader, first of all, in our funding, we actually have very little money for case management. So most of our services are delivered as a piece of some larger set of services that might be managed by AFS, SCF, or mental health, but we are not usually the case manager if it's a complicated case requiring several services. Also, with the DHS reorganization, we've been actually, Dr. Grams and our office, along with others, have been working on developing an integrated database for exactly the reason that you ask your question, so that we can find out which clients are receiving multiple service, target the case management in the appropriate place, and not offer those duplications that you're concerned about. But whether it's existing that way now, I think we have improvements to make, and that's what we're trying to do as we move toward the integration with DHS.
And I can assume that your integrated database, that you're doing it in collaboration with the other agencies that you would partner with.
Yes. Chair Winters, absolutely. And the Office of Information Services and DHS is the lead for all of that work, so that we're all working as a team on that, not separately. Quickly, I want to highlight some of the major program changes, and I'm going to try to move quickly because I know we're very short on time. So there's been changes in the Oregon Health Plan the services for alcohol and drug have been integrated into the health plan in 1995. So that's when we started delivering these services in the health plan and having the services be arranged so that they follow the client need. In 9901, we had the budget initiative, which resulted in a rapid expansion in our system, which was actually, I think, you know, we always talk about how we want expansion, but expansion is extremely challenging, and I think this has been a difficult biennium for our whole system as we grapple with how best to meet the needs of a complex clientele. On page 16, there's a table at the top that just highlights the treatment enhancements. I think you can look at that. But we did deliver enhancements in a number of areas, and in particular tried to engage in a better partnership with housing, because many of our clients have problems staying clean and sober because they don't have a safe and secure place to live. So we were able to partner with Housing and Community Services and actually leverage about an additional $10.5 million in development funds through their office, which resulted in additional housing units being built in local communities, which will now be available for clean and sober housing. So we're very pleased with that partnership, and I think it is an example of an innovation that is proving quite successful.
Representative Schrader.
Well, I guess I'm not sure I share your enthusiasm for that use of the alcohol prevention dollars. And I guess as I total up, I'd like some, at one point when it is appropriate, Madam Chair, some in-depth discussion about the money that was expended last biennium. And I see a lot of dollars here that add up more than $10 million. And so I have some concerns about how the department did handle the money. And I understand there you made a good comment that, you know, expansion can be difficult to manage. So I really need to hear about what happened and what you're doing to take care of it and how that wouldn't happen again and
right.
how we get out of the situation we are in.
Right. Well, Representative Schrader, Chair Winters, first I think I want to point out on 16 there's a typo here that we've just caught, which is under training and accountability, that should be 0.8, not 8 million. So I alleviate some of your concerns there,
yes.
Hopefully. I'm going to try to be brief. We had been before the e-board with some challenges on the budget. As we put forth our expansion, one of the strategies that we had in our mix was a rate change, a rate enhancement, and Senator Yee had asked about that earlier as well. Our residential treatment programs historically had been gravely underfunded. They were only getting about $30 a day to provide room, board, and treatment and so forth. And if you look around the country and just sort of common sense about what it might cost to treat someone in a residential facility, it's far more than that. So we were losing or at risk of losing a number of our facilities because of the rate. What we did in the treatment enhancement was a combination of things. We leveraged Medicaid money in order to bring in a federal match to help us restructure the residential treatment rate. Where we experienced a challenge in this area primarily were that there were a number of beds that were licensed but had not previously been funded as part of the system. So when we made the switch to the higher rate, we encountered some additional beds that had not been in our initial projections. So that's a brief, answer. There also were some additional training and technical assistance costs that we had not anticipated would be needed. But in order to help the providers in this transition, we felt it was essential to keep those going. So that's what led us back to the e-board. I think it also led us to a sort of line-by-line review of everything that we're doing. And although that's been very painful, I think it's also been very instructive as we go forth, because we know that if we're going to meet this challenge, our system has to be in top shape. And so I mean that's briefly what we've done. The one thing I want to stress that we've focused on our administration is to bring together our budgeting, contracting, and outcome process so that we have one database that links all of our data, which may seem like a simple thing, but it is something we'd struggled with, and now have worked through the ability to bring all of our data together so that we can appropriately monitor those costs and programs. So we feel we've made a lot of progress very quickly to try to come to grips with this.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you. Well, since you have a typo on this table anyway, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind bringing us back a table that adds it up to $10 million. At the bottom, and perhaps has another column that shows the leverage and then the total there, and then a grand total between the two. That would be really helpful for me to be able to see where the dollars came in and where the original $10 million actually went.
It was more than $10 million.
I'm glad to do that.
It was more than $10 million, and it was about $19 million all together after the e-board. I'm glad that you're getting a handle on your dollars. You know, my first thought was that what would happen if you hadn't had an e-board? You know, because the fact that e-board was there, and I say this because I think sometimes, you know, it is a responsibility to assure that you're doing the management oversight, that you're not overspending. And if e-board isn't here, and I'm thinking next session when you look at the ending balance, and it may be a possibility that you agencies will not have some place to come to get bailed out. And so I just say that because I think it's important. I know that we need to go to the floor. So several things I'd like to ask that you bring back. And I know that you had a one-page summary, and to me, I'd like it expanded on. I'd like your performance measures to deal with, and it's, if I go through your book, it's all interspersed through it. I'd like you to pull out your actual outcome measures and put them on one sheet, if you will. If I don't ask for it, Senator Yee and the rest of the panel will. And if you do not have a copy of what was done by the Department of Ed, and Employment Division, I thought we had sent to all the agencies that we encapsulated in that kind of form. The other thing that I would like, since your money flows through to counties, that you give us the dollars that you're sending to the counties and what outcomes have resulted from your activity with the county, because you're buying beds from them and you're buying service from them, and somehow we should be able to track that and see what kind of results we're getting from the counties.
Chair Winters, I would mention in Appendix 7 in the back of the book, we do have a one-page.
That is very brief, and it doesn't encapsulate all of your outcomes that you, in fact, have as an agency. And I'd just like you to put all of them there so that we don't have to flip through this to try to find your measurements.
We'll try and do that.
That's what I've been sitting up here doing, trying to...
Right.
We'll
pull that together.
My question was, it's because the $10 million is discussed on page 15, where it identifies that the 99 legislature appropriated $10 million for high-risk youth and families. And that was the part that I wanted specifically pulled out. If the e-board is something that was done in addition, then I'd like to see that separate, because is it that the governor's budget includes an additional $9.2 million to the 10 for this next biennium for high-risk youth as part of the juvenile crime prevention plan? My thinking was yes, it does, and I don't Right, so,
right.
And then the e-board would be something that is yet in addition to that, that's not wrapped into it, so I do want to see that separate.
See, like you have on 18, you have some of your performance and workload measures that are not a part of your appendix in 7, so I would just like to, if you can, put them all on one page, or if it takes two pages, but that they're all combined together so that we're not having to flip through to find them.
One page is better.
Senator, you can if you need it.
Yeah.
Representative Winters, may I ask for a point of clarification?
Sure.
You were requesting that we do a separate for the residential programs?
Yes.
Okay.
Because part of what you do is that you're funding an activity locally, and that local activity is to buy treatment services or whatever you're purchasing. And I think it would be well for this body to know that which you are purchasing and what kind of results that are occurring out there. What are we spending these alcohol and drug dollars for? Also, of course, Barbara and I have talked about this, I would like to have for the group some information on methamphetamine for the not methamphetamine, the methadone treatment program, because I have a serious concern that it's an overutilized drug in treatment, and so I would like that information from those treatment programs as to and you may not have it, but if you do have it, what is the history of what's the length a treatment with inside of those programs, where you may have one program that is 3 months, that on the average you may have another one that is 6 months. On your statistics, I believe on a statewide is something like 2 years. Yet I've heard some information out of Multnomah County. You have people up there that have been on it anywhere from 20 to 25 years. So, and it causes me great concern that we are shifting one drug use for another drug use.
Can we add to that to say what kind of follow-up treatment plans do they have to see whether there's recidivism, what's the rate of recidivism of your program?
Well, and maybe this is a good place for us because we have to go to the floor. Can we get through the rest of this? In 5 minutes?
We can, maybe if I, Chair Winters, I can just kind of...
If you can.
Tell you what's there, so if there's anything we've missed. I think the next section really does focus on the performance measures, and what we tried to do is start with the benchmarks, which we have only two, the student use and the drug-free babies. Then we have a whole section on performance measures, which starts with our prevention outcomes and our treatment outcomes, which is the treatment outcomes focus on information from a survey that we've done, which is a sample of clients. And we'll also bring you back county by county information. Then we talk about our evaluation process. We are working on quality improvement reports, which is on page 22. We have a table with the items that are included.
I'm sorry, I slowed this thing down to a crawl. But page 20, the preliminary results from Portland State University. I'm in this kind of mood today, and I apologize to my colleagues, and I apologize to everyone out there. I'm kind of blunt today, and I'm
good.
Not appropriate. But
having said that,
my colleagues are wondering, geez, if he's first in usual, this is really bad. But, I mean, the survey here is almost inconceivable. I mean, it's hard to believe the results are this good. I mean, clients who reported serious family conflicts before treatment reported no conflicts 6 months later. I mean, I find that hard to believe. You know, I don't get that good in my own family.
We know why.
Yeah.
Good time to adjourn.
a Democrat, too. I mean, it's just the report, the results are extraordinary. I just, you know, when I see that kind of results, it rings a little bell, and I kind of get a little concerned that it's almost hard to believe. I mean, we should have been doing this a long time ago, and I guess I just, you know, I'd like to believe it, but it just strikes me as extraordinary.
Well, Representative Schrader, Chair Winters, I think what we can do is come back and show you the questions that we're asking on the survey. We have taken this from a national model of a survey, so we're using what is sort of the best practice in surveying. But I wouldn't disagree with you with sometimes it sounds a little idealized, but maybe after treatment, people are feeling like they really are doing much better, so their perception of their situation might be better than what we might judge it to be looking from the outside in.
Well, when I see surveys like this, then my question is, then that means that we should be spending, you know, the population should be declining, which means that we should be saving some money somewhere along the line because we're not having to deal with these same people over and over again. And so... when I hear things like, you know, we need more money, I'm asking myself, if we're so successful, 66% less is in unemployment insurance, which tells me they're working, contributing. You know, that's a pretty high number. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it says to me that you're being successful, and success usually says that we don't have to have our bureaucracy as big. It becomes retracted. You know, one of the things I used to say when I was in this building, that we work to work ourselves out of business if we're really doing our job.
That's good.
Representative Bates.
After giving good Representative Schrader a hard time here, I'm also going to be supportive of him. I didn't even get to page 20 as I was looking at this stuff. I looked at alcohol drug use during pregnancy on page 19 through before, and it showed a steady decline in alcohol use during pregnancy, and it's based on birth certificates turned in, and I know absolutely those are bogus figures. The self-reporting again by pregnant women and physicians who are too busy to completely fill out a very cumbersome, a long form that we use for birth certificates. I mean, this thing's long, it's small print. The fact is, it's not accurately filled out by most physicians. The information here can't possibly be correct. It can't be correct. Okay, and when I look at the same situation, the treatment outcome, this is a random survey by the first 80 people came in, self-reported. I just can't believe this information is correct, and I see a burgeoning population of people having drug abuse problems. We need to think very differently about how we collect our data, and that the only way we could accurately collect data is not by self-reporting. I think self-reporting, personally, having worked with physicians who are trying to beat the system for alcohol and drug addiction, is bogus, completely, totally bogus. The only way you do it is get some urine or some blood, and the results are incredible compared to what they're telling us. And now we get into all kinds of personal rights issues. I know that's a fact, but if you at least set up a pilot program where you could get some idea on a scientific basis what your outcomes are, you might get a handle on what you're really trying to deal with here, which is a huge problem.
Representative Bates, Representative Winters, excuse me, I'm not very good at my protocol yet. I am the person who does our data, and I just wanted to let you know about something that we're implementing in order to validate the results that we're seeing in our surveys. We have managed to hook our data to several other data sets, the corrections data set, other DHS agencies, and we're hoping to use this as a validity check on what we're getting in the self-report. So if they're telling us they haven't been arrested and we see an arrest showing up in another database, we'll be able to gauge the accuracy. I can tell you for now, and again, these are preliminary results, we have been seeing that they are reporting a higher degree than even what we're able to come up with in the archival databases. So there's some support for the idea that they are tending to be truthful in their responses to us. Just one final comment on this, because I don't want to end with feeling like our data is bogus. So, Representative Bates, Chair Winters.
I know. I
think one of the things that we did the biennium before last was we had a contractor do an absolutely objective study. We weren't able to just do it by blood and urine because, as you point out, there's some challenges with that. But we went through all the state databases and followed people who had been through treatment and then looked at what their further contact was with it was with state systems. We do plan in the 0103 to repeat that study. I think some of you know the Finnegan study, which was the one that said for every $5.60 we spend in alcohol and drug treatment, or for every dollar we spend, we save $5.60. Now, that is much more objective because it actually follows people who've been through treatment and looks at their further use of state services, and that is something that we plan to repeat because this is just one avenue. In order to really know how we're doing, we need to do a number of things. Look at the county data, look at the individual client data, and then look at the use of other state services. But as is pointed out, that is time consuming and also costly. So we try to replicate certain things every few years as we can afford to do that.
But Barbara, do you know, given taking population and all the other factors, which county has the highest incidence of alcohol and drug use?
Proportionately?
Mm-hmm.
Glenn will I want to look it up before I say it, so I'm sure that I'm not wrong.
So if we know that, do we target our funds based on those kind of statistics?
In some cases, we do representative winners, and we certainly try to focus on where the need is greatest as we have new dollars. But in other ways, though, we have some historical components of the system that has placed programs in certain areas, so we don't always have access to all kinds of services in every county.
But where you know that a county has high incidences and where the need is the greatest, and you know, I know one of the things that the governor has tried to do with this budget is to craft this budget based on need,
right?
You know, with the highest priority. So it seems to me that even our funding stream or how we get at those issues would also follow that path, and that's why I asked that question, because if we're not, then we're not taking care or addressing, you know, those very grim and complicated cases.
Well, Chair Winches, we will bring you back a picture county by county with some of the issues you raised today.
Senator Yee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on page 19 also. On the top, it says table 3% of eighth grade students reporting use in the past 30 days. In 1998, alcohol use was 26%, and your target for 2000 is 26%. Shouldn't you be a little bit more aggressive and put your target at 6% lower or something? Why should the goal be 26% when you already reached that goal in
98? Senator Yee, those targets are set by the Oregon Progress Board. So this is what's printed in their report of the Oregon benchmarks.
But what's your own target?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we of course would like to see this to be much lower, but this is set according to, you know, a larger process.
Madam Chair, I think you should set your own target to be at least lower than what you have already achieved in 98. And I would like to suggest that when they give us their performance report, give us their goals for 01, 02, 03, so we know with the funding they get, what kind of result they are aiming to achieve.
Senator, I have one short request.
Awesome.
And it may be somewhere in the book, but I haven't found it yet. On page 16, you talked about 20 counties choosing the flexible funding option. Could you just give me a list of what those counties are?
And Representative Carlson, for this coming biennium, all of the counties are being moved to this, where they will have to have a plan and prioritize their needs and their goals and objectives. So we're moving toward, I think, what Chair Winters has asked on that.
I'd like to see which 20 got the head start.
Thank you. Is there any further questions? I want to, when we will adjourn the work session, and I want to, before I adjourn the committee, I want to share with you, you had in front of you this morning another article that I think another article where there was an apology on the insensitive comment, and I did have a conversation with the administrator yesterday. In fact, he was in my office this morning, and I understand that Mr. Neely is coming to give us a letter in writing from the agency itself. They have had a conversation with the consultant. The agency was not aware of this document at all that the consultant used. So just to share with you the background and what happened, the agency is just as outraged as we were about hearing that the consultant had that item of the dumpster on the list.
But I don't understand how come the agency is not aware.
Well, it was a
kind of material.
Yeah, it was a contractor that they've had for years and years, you know, and just assume that everything was fine. And now one of the, we talked about having within the system a review of all literature before and approve it. And so I think that the agency is taking all this into consideration and will probably make sure this doesn't happen again.
The Senate has a letter going to Bob Mink asking for an investigation and asking for what appropriate action they're taking.
Well, I will send you a copy of the letter that I received from Mr. Neely today so that you have a copy of that, and I'll send it to the Senate. With that, we are adjourned.
You got that message.